Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Tonight on the Mehdi Hassan Show, civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump is here. His client, 16-year-old Ralph Yarl, shot by a man who was fed a diet of fear and paranoia by conservative cable news. Plus, the fight to hold Clarence Thomas accountable for his multiple ethical lapses. Why aren't Democrats playing hardball? And the Kennedys are calling out one of their own as he announces a controversial run for president. Good evening, I'm Mehdi Hassan. This is Ralph Yarl, a 16-year-old from Kansas City, Missouri. He's a star student, excellent athlete, and a talented musician. His teachers and friends describe him as a, quote, quiet and kind soul that's always willing to help. As the father of a 16-year-old myself, I can tell you he's the type of kid that would make any parent beam with pride. He's even a great older brother. On April the 13th, Yarl's mother asked him to pick up his younger brothers from a friend's house. According to court documents, just before 10 p.m., Yarl walked up to the door and rang the bell. However, unbeknownst to him, he was actually at the wrong address. That's happened to a lot of us, right? Knocking on the wrong door? Well, Yarl waited at the doorway and then saw a man answer with a firearm in hand. And from there, things escalated quickly. Yarl says he was shot almost immediately, first in the head. And while he was still on the ground, the shooter opened fire a second time, striking Yarl in the arm. That's when the teenager, remember, says he heard the man say, quote, don't come around here. 16-year-old Yarl, miraculously, after being shot twice, was able to get up and run away. He told police he tried to get help from multiple residences, from multiple neighbors, before someone finally called 911. The teenager was taken to the hospital and treated for his wounds. The bullet that struck his head left him with a critical, traumatic brain injury. He's since been released from the hospital and is now, thankfully, recovering at home. The man who shot Yarl, 84-year-old Andrew Lester, has been charged with two felony counts, assault in the first degree and armed criminal action. Yarl's shooting quickly captured the attention of the nation as yet another devastating story about a young life changed forever by gun violence. But there's also something else at work here. This is undeniably a story not just about guns, but about race, too. Here's Clay County Prosecutor Zachary Thompson.
Was there a racial component to this case?
As the prosecutor at Clay County, I can tell you there was a racial component to the case.
Although it hasn't been classed as a racially motivated crime, it's not difficult to understand how race could play a role when you consider the neighborhood Yarl found himself in that night. According to one of his attorneys, it's a predominantly white and conservative area. Residents told NBC News there's an unspoken rule among local black and Latino people that the area is, quote, off limits to people of color. However, Yarl's case speaks to a much larger issue than a single neighborhood in Kansas City. It strikes at the heart of how we as a society see and treat black children. Consider this. Lester described Yarl as a, quote, black male, approximately 6 feet tall, and noted that his size is what made the 84-year-old fear for his life. However, Lester's estimate is several inches off the teen's actual height, which, according to his parents, is 5'8". Back in 2014, when a police officer shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice, the president of the Cleveland Police Patrolmen's Association defended that officer by describing Rice as, quote, a 12-year-old in an adult body. And according to multiple studies, when people are asked to judge the size of black people, they tend to see black men as bigger and stronger than they actually are. A separate study found that black kids were seen as significantly less innocent than their white counterparts. We should be clear. We do not know yet if Lester's actions were racially motivated, but we do know that Lester has, quote, racist tendencies. That's according to his own grandson, Carl Ludwig, who said that in recent years, his grandfather had further, quote, fell down the right-wing rabbit hole, fully buying into the Fox News OAN kind of line, becoming immersed in a 24-hour news cycle of fear and paranoia. In a new op-ed for the Kansas City Star, Melinda Henneberger argues that although Lester pulled the trigger that night, he did not act alone. His accomplice, cable news. She says that right-wing media has to bear some responsibility for Lester's actions. Quote, a 24/7 diet of spicy race-baiting and white nationalist talking points is corrosive. As she notes, in the days after Yarl's shooting, viewers tuning into Fox's primetime lineup, just as Lester did, were greeted with stories of roving gangs and looting mobs. And when the network did cover Yarl's shooting, Fox made sure to downplay the incident and empathize with Lester.
You can imagine yourself on both sides of the store, going to the wrong residence to pick up your siblings, literally got the wrong address. And all of a sudden, as you're standing at the doorbell, shots ringing out. You can also imagine yourself on the other side, an 84-year-old man with a 6-foot-tall guy outside your door, reportedly pulling on the glass outer door to come inside. Here's what I would tell you. This is a tragedy, but there is zero evidence that it is racist.
A reminder. Ralph Yarl isn't 6 feet tall, and it's funny that that Fox host should mention his height, but not his race. Look, on April the 13th, Ralph Yarl, 16 years old, not 6 feet tall, went to the wrong house, a mistake any one of us could make. But in a country where we view black people as threats, young black men in particular, even black boys, and in a country where old white armed men are being fed a right-wing media diet of fear and paranoia, incidents like these aren't as shocking as they should be. Ralph Yarl may have survived this horrific shooting, but until we come to terms as a nation with our gun and our race problems, there will be many more Ralph Yarls, sadly. Joining me now is Benjamin Crump, a civil rights attorney who represents the family of Ralph Yarl. Ben, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I have to begin by asking you, how is Ralph Yarl doing tonight?
Well, Maddie, he is continuing to have headaches. He's going to have the traumatic brain injury, even though he is miraculously able to communicate and hasn't lost his cognitive faculties. But the doctors say it's going to be a long time before he can return to school. So please keep him in prayer.
We will do, for sure. Ben, let's talk about what the Clay County prosecutor described as a, quote, racial component within this case. He hasn't elaborated much on that detail, but what we do know is that Lester is not being charged with a hate crime. So what can you tell us about the role that you think, or the family thinks, that race played in this shooting?
Well, we haven't seen the probable cause report or the completed police report, but from the family's perspective, as many in the black community's perspective, there's certainly a racial dynamic at play here. For one, if the roles would have been reversed and it would have been a black homeowner citizen who shot a 16-year-old teenage child for simply ringing his doorbell, we know without a shadow of a doubt they wouldn't have questioned him for only 20 minutes and let him come home and sleep in his bed at night. It harkens back to Trayvon Martin's killer being allowed to go home and sleep in his bed at night. And even in more recent history, the lynch mob that hunted and shot Ahmaud Arbery, even though it was on video, they still got to go home and sleep in their beds at night. So we know there's certainly a racial component involved here.
Ben, how much do you think Missouri's stand your ground law will play in here for the defense, for the general commentary around the case? A lot of people believe, understandably, that a lot of these stand your ground laws are rooted in white supremacy.
Well, we certainly believe, again, if the roles would have been reversed, a black citizen would not have been able to be exonerated for stand your ground or the Castle Doctrine or any other stand your self-defense argument. But this is going to be critical here in Missouri, because we know that this white citizen is going to say he feared a 16-year-old Ralph Yaw. Why? He can't really explain it. We believe the crime that he believed Ralph Yaw was guilty of was the color of his skin, and that he profiled this young teenager and shot him in the head first and then shot a second time at his chest area. And had Ralph not had his arm there, the bullet would have likely went into his chest, and we may not have been talking about assault in the first degree. We may be talking about some form of homicide.
Yes, it is miraculous that he survived. One last question for you, Ben. I want to get your reaction to that research I shared a few moments ago, that black children, particularly black boys, are often perceived as older, more threatening, less innocent than their white counterparts. How have you seen this kind of implicit racial bias come into play in the cases of violence and assault and shootings of black men that you've represented over the years all over the country?
Yeah, Meta, it is astonishing how often black young people, especially teenagers, are seen older than they are, bigger than they are, taller than they are, and less presumed innocent than they are. You think about Trayvon Martin walking home with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea, talking on the phone to his high school classmate. Then you think about Tamir Rice, I mean, a 12-year-old kid who they tried to say was an adult. And then you look at Ralph and you just say, hold on, what can our children do, America, for you to see them as children? Why can't we have the same consideration that you give to others? But we know we have to continue to fight to make it one justice system for America.
Well said. Benjamin Crump, thank you for your time tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, bro.
Let's continue this important conversation with Molly Jong-Fast, host of the Fast Politics podcast, and David Henderson, a civil rights attorney, former prosecutor, and now CNBC contributor. David, you and I have spoken before about how police officers perceive threats from young black men, unarmed men, whether at traffic stops or wherever else they find them, often results in them using deadly force. But as this case shows, it's not just the police. What do you make of the shooter's argument here that he feared for his life and therefore he had to shoot the teenager? And he's making a case in a state which, as I mentioned to Ben Crump a moment ago, has a stand your ground law.
You know, Mehdi, the first thought I have is normally if you and I start a discussion about gun control or guns in any way, I'm going to say people need minimal training at least to have that firearm. This is one situation where you almost want to think, thank God he's a terrible shot, because he tried to kill this young man. And what you have to keep in mind is the racism is not new, the guns aren't new, and you're inclined to think it's just a problem with racism or guns. And what it actually is a problem with conservative leaders empowering racist gun owners. And you have to take a step back to look at the history of how we got here to put it in perspective. The law used to be you can own a gun, you can defend yourself with a gun, but if you can avoid shooting someone, do. And people actually said, well, hang on, I shouldn't have to do that in my own house. I said, you know, you're right. We should have a castle doctrine where you can shoot people and kill them in your house if you feel threatened. You take that a step further to people saying, I should be allowed to do that in public, stand my ground wherever I have the right to be. Again, conservative lawmakers said, fine. Then along comes Kyle Rittenhouse. Regardless of how you feel about whether or not he should have been convicted, people celebrated what he did on the conservative side. You would think it would stop there. But recently here in Texas, our governor actually said he is going to pardon someone, a jury convicted of murder, for killing a Black Lives Matter protester. So set aside the gun policies. You're talking now about being able to use them beyond the law and be protected when you do. What message does that send to someone who gets nervous by, and let me ask you, is there any documented account in history of a bass clarinetist being a menace to society? One knocks on your door and you feel like you have to kill them because you're so threatened about the possibility of what they might do, despite the fact that they haven't threatened to do anything to you.
And that case in Texas you mentioned, we discussed it on the show very recently. also the shooter there, turned out to be a racist. Molly, according to this shooter's grandson, he was someone who pushed a lot of racist views, and he was an avid consumer of far-right media, including Fox. Does that network's obsessive coverage of crime, of black crime in particular, make networks like Fox, OAN, etc., almost complicit in building a culture of fear and racial paranoia that can, at times like these, prove almost deadly?
That's a very hard question to answer. What I would say is that certainly they want their viewers to get to feel scared. And there's a lot of media that is targeted towards these viewers to make them feel scared. I mean, you'll remember the midterm caravans. Remember the caravans?
Yes.
Only Trump can stop the caravans. There are these caravans, and they would do, you know, months and months in caravans. And then the day after the midterms, the caravans disappeared. So certainly they are very interested in their viewership. And they know their viewership is older, and they know that if they make cities seem scary, that gets them excited. I mean, remember, the Fox News is essentially the messaging arm of the GOP. So they are, you know, not, they're working, as we've seen with the Dominion suit, a lot of times they're working hand in glove. And part of this GOP's thing is to get their base very nervous and worried that Democrats will do something, that they will make cities unmanageable, that they will bring socialism. So this is part of a sort of larger plan. Now, are there unintended consequences to this? It's certainly possible.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned the 2018 midterms and the caravan, because, of course, the 2022 midterms, they had the violent crime wave that they were obsessed with and then stopped talking about straight after the 22 midterms. But of course, people like this shooter in Missouri, who knows what they internalized from the coverage? I guess we'll find out at trial. Molly and David, please do stick around. Much more to discuss. Up next, how a culture of camaraderie is helping to protect embattled Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Stay with us.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
In an ideal world, Supreme Court justices would do something, anything, to reform their pitifully bad reputation with the American public, to try and restore it. Or you could just do what former Justice Stephen Breyer did. This week, he spoke of scandal-ridden Justice Clarence Thomas in glowing terms, calling him a friend and, I kid you not, a, quote, man of integrity. Justice Breyer, let me say this, renowned TV fixer Olivia Pope wouldn't touch Clarence Thomas with a 10-foot pole right now. But, you know, it follows a well-worn pattern of liberals on the court befriending and defending their extremist colleagues on the bench. Remember the late Justice Antonin Scalia, you know, the one who voted, among other things, against Obergefell v. Hodges, which required states to legalize same-sex marriage, who defended torture because, you know, TV's Jack Bauer did it too. Thanks to his friendship with the late liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we couldn't stop hearing about their adorable trips to the opera, so much so that it was the subject of a 2015 comic opera called Scalia Ginsburg. So it comes as no surprise that Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin has failed to get Chief Justice John Roberts to respond to his invitation to testify on the ethical problems with the court and Clarence Thomas, because they all stick together. That's what they do. My panel is back with me. David and Molly. Also joining us, Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent for Vox. He's written extensively about the GOP's transformation of the Supreme Court in his book titled The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Ian, let me start with you. I want to play this sound of Dick Durbin on Meet the Press this morning explaining why he invited John Roberts to testify, but not Clarence Thomas. Have a listen.
I know what would happen to that invitation. It would be ignored. It is far better from my point of view to have the Chief Justice here. Listen, this is John Roberts' court. We are dealing with a situation where history will remember it as such.
Ian, do you buy that? And what should the Democratic-led but rather weak Senate Judiciary Committee be doing right now?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is there's not really anything that can be done about Clarence Thomas. I mean, you could shine a light on him. You can get people to understand that he's a Republican appointee. And if they don't want more people like him, they shouldn't vote for the Republican Party. But, you know, Dick Durbin can hold hearings. Chief Justice Roberts could potentially, you know, shake his fist in frustration at Clarence Thomas. But at the end of the day, the only way to remove him, no matter how corrupt he is or no matter how bonkers his decision is impeachment. That requires 67 votes in the Senate. That requires, you know, 12, or no, I'm doing the math wrong. That requires 16 Republicans to vote to remove him. And I mean, Clarence Thomas could go on TV and butcher and eat a live baby, and you wouldn't get 16 Republican senators to vote to remove him from office and be replaced by a Joe Biden appointee.
David, do you agree with that? I mean, there have been calls for House Democrats to get behind someone like AOC, who has called for impeachment. I mean, some House Democrats have said Thomas should resign. He's not going to resign. He's not going to get convicted, as Ian points out. And yet the evidence against him and his wife just keeps piling up. Do we do nothing?
Maddie, we don't do nothing. But starting off with the question, do I agree? 100%. And here's part of the reason why. The image that keeps getting circulated of Clarence Thomas sitting in the semicircle talking to other conservatives while he's on vacation, I initially thought that was a photograph. When I found out it was a painting, my question was, how often do you have to vacation someplace for them to put a painting of you up on the wall? And here's the answer to that question. You have to vacation there often enough for everyone to know you vacation there, including your boss. So what that means is it may be news to the rest of the public. This isn't news to John Roberts or anyone else that Clarence Thomas was doing these things. And the reason that's important is because it's going to keep on the exact same way it has been. And when you try to criticize Clarence Thomas, just going to be real about this, building on our previous segment, you aren't simply criticizing a conservative judge. You're criticizing someone who has come to symbolize for a vast percentage of conservatives, hey, we're not racist, because we love Clarence Thomas. So when you try to attack those two icons simultaneously, you set up a recipe for disaster. And the question the rest of us need to be asking is, if we're going to put these philosopher kings and queens in these positions, shouldn't there be some degree of regulation about what they do and not do that pulls them so far apart from the way the rest of us live our lives, given that they make choices influencing how we live our lives?
Molly, in regards to Stephen Breyer's rather ridiculous comments that Thomas is a man of integrity, is it any wonder that conservatives keep getting away with this stuff? At what point are Democrats going to stop living in this West Wing style fantasy world where everyone in politics is acting in good faith and we should all just get along?
Right. Well, I mean, the Supreme Court has really pushed Democrats, I think, in a way that many of us, I mean, a lot, none of us thought they were going to overturn Roe. I mean, even when they took SB 8 on the shadow docket, there were still people saying, well, they will never overturn Roe. And the last session was such a radical session, and they did so many radical things, from gun laws in New York State to, you know, curbing the power of the EPA, that I think it was really a moment for a lot of Democrats where many of us were pretty shocked. So I do think, yes, I think this has to be addressed. But I mean, I do think there just aren't mechanisms for this. And in some ways, I mean, what Durbin is trying to do is that for a long time, John Roberts was able to push the court not to go as crazy as they wanted.
Yeah.
So I think he thinks that maybe he can go back to him and get him to start doing that again. I think he's lost control of the situation, but we'll see.
Ian, quick last one to you. David mentioned regulation. You've written a book on the Supreme Court. Does Clarence Thomas basically energize Democrats and get them to call for things like expanding the court or at least term limits, no more life appointments for these quote unquote philosopher kings, to borrow David's phrase?
Yeah. Well, the difficulty with term limits is I think that's hard to do without a constitutional amendment. You could get to court packing. And I think the way that it's going to happen is the same way that filibuster reform happened several years ago, which is that there's going to need to be a series of consecutive outrages. You know, Roe was overturned. I think that was the first outrage. And if we see more outrages like that, I think that's the point where you start to see Democrats line up and say, hey, this court is out of control. It is, you know, it is taking away our democracy because the court is deciding too many cases in ways that, it, you know, that Congress doesn't agree with, that the people's representatives don't agree with, that the president doesn't agree with. And at some point, you know, again, if there are enough outrages, I think court packing could be on the table.
Of course, all of this requires a functioning Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to be talking a lot more about that later in the show. David Henderson, thank you so much for your time today. Molly and Ian, please stick around. After the break, a news update on the crisis in Sudan after U.S. forces safely evacuated personnel and their families from the U.S. embassy. A lot more to come tonight. Don't go away.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening?, we're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening? Wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Let's just say it out loud. Democrats have a Dianne Feinstein problem since her absence in February. Senator Feinstein has missed 58 Senate votes, 25 of them for judicial nominees and 13 for executive branch nominees. And yet President Biden and Senate Democrats are still tap dancing around growing and understandable calls for her resignation, her retirement. When will Democrats finally learn from their mistakes with Ruth Bader Ginsburg? I mean, they could have pushed Ginsburg to retire back when Dems had the Senate majority during President Obama's term in office, but they didn't. And we all know how that turned out. It is past time for Democrats to stop waiting for an 89-year-old Feinstein to retire and start demanding she do so. As Molly Jongfast puts it, Feinstein is, quote, clearly unable to do her job, and that puts millions of Americans at risk of losing fundamental rights. Let's bring back Molly Jongfast and Ian Millhiser. Molly, Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin is, and I'm not making this up, calling on GOP senators to, quote, show a little kindness towards Dianne Feinstein as they appear unlikely to help replace her temporarily on that committee. Kindness, he wants. Has Dick Durbin been asleep for the past decade, Molly? The GOP is just going to help him out with kindness?
Well, and they already said they weren't going to help him out, right? They've already gone on the
surprise
record. Republicans and said they won't let her fill the seat. I mean, the whole idea that she would step off the judiciary temporarily, she's not running again. There's no plan for her to come back. She's still sick. There was a piece in Roll Call recently where one of her staffers said that they really don't think she's going to be able to come back. So clearly, this is not a person who is coming back. And again, I just want to specify, I don't think this is a function of her being too old. I think this is a function of her not being able to be in the job. And as we all know, there comes a time when if you can't do a job, someone else is does it. And I think that's where we are now. And what I thought was a little bit hopeful, and again, you know, this is the Senate, so yeah, it has its own weird rules. But today, Lindsey Graham did say that if she does resign, they will seat a replacement. So I do think she does need to resign. She can't have special rules. She's obviously not, you know, we know she's not coming back, and it's time. And I think people around her need to have
it's
the hard conversation.
Time. It's past time. It was time when she was hugging Lindsey Graham, saying he did a great job of getting Amy Coney Barrett confirmed. Ian, explain to our viewers the damage that's being done to Democratic Party attempts to fill crucial judicial vacancies by Feinstein's ongoing absence from the committee.
So this is one of these problems that gets worse the longer it goes on. So the ordinary process is that when there are judicial nominees, and like these are the nominees that we need in order to dilute the votes of judges who think like Clarence Thomas, they have a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, they have a vote in the Judiciary Committee. After they are voted out of the Judiciary Committee, then they get a vote on the floor. Without a working Democratic majority, because if Feinstein's not there, the Judiciary Committee is evenly split, they can't vote new nominees out of committee. Now, the Republicans have been allowing some nominees to vote out of committee, but they've basically now been using their power to veto nominees that they really don't want. And so eventually you're going to get a bottleneck. There is a process to discharge nominees from the Senate Judiciary Committee, even if the committee itself won't vote them out. That was the process Democrats had to use over and over again during the previous Senate when everything was split 50-50. But now Democrats have a real working majority. They have 51 senators. And so they should be able to govern in the way that you have, you know, that you can when you have a 51 seat majority. And that means that like these nominees should just be printing nominees. And the only way you can just keep printing these nominees is to have a fully functional Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
Molly, what really frustrates me is when people say, oh, well, you know, you're being sexist by asking her to stand down. Nancy Pelosi suggested that people were being sexist calling for her to stand down. The same argument was made about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But that's nonsense, because people like me, I wrote a column saying Stephen Breyer should stand down, who's a man. And to be fair to Stephen Breyer, as much as I criticize him, he did stand down and allowed Joe Biden to replace him. So why not do that now with Dianne Feinstein? Allow Gavin Newsom to replace her. It's not ageism. It's not sexism. It's just practical. It's politics.
Right. And this is, I mean, this, you can say anything is anything, right? But clearly in this case, it's not. So I think it's important to point out we are in the middle of a judicial emergency, right? We have a Trump justice, a district court judge who is trying to take a drug off the market that's been approved for 23 years because he doesn't like what it does. OK, they overturned Roe. I mean, this judiciary is like ready to remake the country as The Handmaid's Tale. And this woman has an ego and doesn't want to step down. Like, this is not okay. Like, this is an emergency.
I mean, I'm not even sure if it's her ego. We don't know what she's thinking or what her state of mind is. We know that her staff are speaking on behalf. We haven't heard from her directly. Molly Jong-Fast, Ian Millhiser, thank you both for your analysis. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for president. He's the fourth Kennedy to run for the White House. And I'm going to tell you all about him, some of the worrying things you need to know about this particular Kennedy. Don't go away. Joe Biden may not be facing any major challenges for the 2024 Democratic presidential nomination from senior members of his own party, from any governors or senators or the like. But this past Wednesday, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the 69-year-old environmental lawyer and third child of RFK, formally announced he was running for the Democratic presidential nomination, becoming the fourth Kennedy to launch a White House run.
My mission over the next 18 months of this campaign and throughout my presidency will be to end the corrupt merger of state and corporate power that 4 out of every 5 toxic waste dumps in our country is in a black neighborhood. The largest toxic waste dump in this country is Emile, Alabama, which is 85% black. We can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy, and we can make a few people billionaires by impoverishing the rest of us. But our children are going to pay for our joyride.
Now, I'll be honest, a lot of that really resonates with me, and I'm sure with many on the left. A candidate willing to condemn the consolidation of corporate power, the evils of environmental racism, and ever-increasing income inequality. And a Kennedy to boot. What more could Democrats ask for? Well, A lot, actually. Sadly, there's plenty wrong with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his long-shot presidential bid. Here's just three worrying things among many that you should know about him. First, Robert Kennedy Jr. is one of America's leading anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists. He and his Children's Health Defense Group have spent years amplifying discredited and dangerous nonsense, linking vaccines to autism and death. And during the pandemic, he and his group became some of the biggest promoters of anti-COVID vaccine conspiracy theories, making a ton of money off of ridiculous claims that Bill Gates was using microchips to surveil and maybe even starve the American people, and also offensive analogies with the Holocaust.
Even in Hitler's Germany, you could cross the Alps into Switzerland. You can hide in an attic like Anne Frank did. I visited in 1962 East Germany with my father and met people who had climbed the wall and escaped. So it was possible. Many died doing it, but it was possible. Today, the mechanisms are being put in place that will make it so none of us can run and none of us can hide.
A, does he know what happened to Anne Frank after she hid in the attic? B, he was condemned by the Auschwitz Memorial for that. And C, while he later apologized for that comment, he has a long history of making Nazi and Holocaust references in relation to vaccines, and even put out a video showing Anthony Fauci in a Hitler mustache. In fact, Kennedy published a best-selling book called The Real Anthony Fauci, in which he accuses the acclaimed doctor and public health expert of executing a, quote, historic coup d'etat against Western democracy. This is bonkers stuff. It's also super reckless and super dangerous. A reminder, the anti-vaxxer movement that Kennedy helps lead in this country has a lot of innocent American blood on its hands. One study found that up until April of 2022, COVID vaccines could have prevented more than 300,000 American deaths, a number that is surely much higher today, a year later. Oh, and by the way, when Kennedy and his wife hosted a holiday party in December of 2021, the invite urged guests to be COVID vaccinated. He conveniently blamed his wife for that. Second, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. might be running for the Democratic presidential nomination, and he might be saying a few left-wing sounding things, but he's backed by former Trump advisor and far-right organizer Steve Bannon. Yes, Bannon, reports CBS News' Robert Costa, has been encouraging Kennedy to run for months, believing he could be both a useful chaos agent in the 2024 race and a big name who could help stoke anti-vaccine sentiment around the country. A chaos agent. In fact, Kennedy met with then-President-elect Trump in January 2017 to discuss a job in the Trump administration and even accepted an offer to run a vaccine safety task force for Trump, which thankfully never got off the ground. And Kennedy hasn't hidden his far-right MAGA ties. As the AP reported, a photo posted on Instagram showed Kennedy backstage at a July 2021 Reawaken America event with former President Trump's ally Roger Stone, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and anti-vaccine profiteer Charlene Bollinger. All three have promoted the lie about the 2020 election being stolen. So forgive me if I don't buy Kennedy's left-wing credentials, and I'm not surprised that he went on Tucker Carlson's White Power Hour on Fox to promote his Democratic presidential bid. Lastly, RFK Jr. may have the support of Steve Bannon, but he doesn't have the support of his own family, of the rest of the Kennedy clan. Yes, the man whose real claim to fame is that he's the third eldest of the late Bobby Kennedy's 11 kids has been publicly denounced by many of the other Kennedy kids, the people who know him best. Writing in Politico in 2019, his elder siblings, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend and Joseph P. Kennedy II, condemned their brother's conspiracism, saying he had helped to spread dangerous misinformation over social media and is complicit in sowing distrust of the science behind vaccines. Earlier this month, his younger siblings, Kerry Kennedy and Doug Kennedy, distanced themselves from him as well. So, forgive me, but a Bannon-backed, Tucker-platformed anti-vaxxer conspiracy theorist who's running on his Kennedy name but can't count on the support of the actual Kennedys is perhaps not the progressive or principled or anti-establishment or liberal Democratic Party champion that he might want you to think he is. Thank you for watching. We will be right back here next Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern. You can now find this show on the MSNBC Hub on Peacock. A new episode of the Mehdi Hasan Show posts on Peacock every week. But now it's time to hand it over to my good friend Ayman Mohyuddin. Ayman, Elon Musk, we've discussed him before, finally got rid of the blue check marks on Twitter this weekend, part of his drive, he claimed, to restore people power to the site and raise revenue for Twitter, which he ludicrously overpaid for. And Ayman, last night, I discovered that he'd given me back my blue check mark, even though I didn't pay for it and would never pay for it. In fact, loads of prominent Twitter accounts of public figures, turns out celebrities, people with more than a million followers, it seems, had their blue check marks, their verified check marks restored, and then instantly said, as I did, get rid of it. I don't want it. Now, aside from the dishonesty, Ayman, of claiming people are paying for your product when they're not, how does it even make sense? I'm no billionaire. I didn't go to business school. But I'm pretty sure it isn't a smart business move to force your unpopular product onto famous people so that those famous people can then tell the world unprompted how much they hate that product and don't want to be associated with it.
I mean, listen, the irony in all of this was that Elon Musk, you know, the billionaire who had positioned himself as a man of the people, determined to bring equality to the Twitter sphere, had initially criticized the previous system of who received blue check marks and who didn't. In fact, he actually once posted that I believe we have it. The process by which Twitter was verifying its users, you know, basically who they claimed or who they actually claimed to be was a system that he described as lords and peasants. And he wanted to end that elitism so that anyone on Twitter who paid the fee could be verified. And now when he realized that verified users would rather run away from his health site than pay the $8 to be verified, the lord of Twitter himself has arbitrarily bestowed upon his chosen users the Musk verification badge. And as you pointed out, it seemed only accounts with more than a million followers were knighted against their will. So my question is, against your will, how insulting is it that the masses, the majority of Twitter users who have less than a million followers are made to pay for their verification badges, while the few that do have a million followers were given theirs freely? I guess, listen, maybe I'm a little bit sour by the fact that I don't have a million followers. And in Elon Musk's world, I'm a peasant, but it's a badge of honor I would wear proudly.
You're not a peasant to me, Ayman. You'll never be a peasant. We're equal. We're equal in Twitter world now.
All right, my friend. It's great to see you as always. Great show. Enjoy the rest of your evening off.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.